This is VOA Asia Weekend. During the next 60 minutes, you'll be able to hear many of the top stories that made up our daily VOA Asia program. In Washington, I'm Ira Melman. U.S. allies have given a cautious welcome to the announcement of a second summit between President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un to be held in Vietnam later this month. The U.S. leader also said during his State of the Union address Tuesday that peace talks with the Taliban in Afghanistan must be given a chance, and he pledged to pull American troops out of costly wars. Henry Ridgewell reports on global reaction to a speech widely seen as light on foreign policy.
President Donald Trump announced he will meet North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in late February in the Vietnamese city of Da Nang, the latest milestone in what Trump claimed as a major success of his term in office.
Nuclear testing has stopped, and there has not been a missile launch in more than 15 months.
South Korea welcomed the summit announcement, but called for specific and practical actions to be agreed upon. Seoul is taking a cautious approach, says U.S. policy analyst and author James Boyes.
I would imagine that there are many people in South Korea who are concerned at this point that perhaps Donald Trump might continue that withdrawal process and talk about bringing American troops home from the Korean Peninsula in exchange for any nuclear agreement.
To gasps from some in the audience, Trump said America would likely be at war with North Korea had his Democratic rival Hillary Clinton won the presidency in 2016. His claims of success in negotiations with Pyongyang are disputed, says Leslie Vinjamuri, head of the U.S. program at Policy Group Chatham House.
There's still evidence that they are committed to their nuclear program.
Trump repeated his pledge to bring American troops home from costly wars.
We have spent more than $7 trillion in fighting wars in the Middle East. As a candidate for president, I loudly pledged a new approach. Great nations do not fight endless wars.
He added that Islamic State had been largely defeated in Syria, but there are growing concerns among allies over an American withdrawal from long-running conflicts, says Chatham House's Leslie Vinjamuri.
As to whether you can really rely on the Taliban to deliver on any peace settlement that might be agreed, certainly a lot of concern by women in Afghanistan of what that would mean. And again, he's, you know, same line that he's going to pull America's troops out of Syria. And there's very grave concern there about what the implications of that will be for stability in Syria, for ISIS, the threat from ISIS, whether that will grow.
Separately, Trump criticized Russia's purported violation of a Cold War-era missile treaty that both Washington and Moscow have pulled out of in recent days, and warned that without a new agreement, the U.S. would outspend and out-innovate all others. Again, analyst James Boyes.
It's notable that he was very critical of European leaders, NATO allies, claiming that they've had to be dragged kicking and screaming to pay their share of the defense expenditure, for example, and yet spoke quite warmly of people like President Xi, for example, from China.
Trump was referring to the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces, or INF, treaty. The U.S. vowed to withdraw from the treaty in 6 months unless Moscow ends what the U.S. calls violations of the landmark 1987 Arms Control Pact. Russian President Vladimir Putin said earlier Moscow will start working on creating new missiles, including hypersonic weapons, and told his ministers not to initiate disarmament talks with Washington. With little new in terms of U.S. foreign policy, the impression from afar is the State of the Union address was aimed at addressing Trump's challenges at home. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
We continue now. You have heard President Donald Trump announce that he'll hold a second summit meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un later this month in Vietnam. Not everyone agrees that such a second meeting should take place. One such person is Nicholas Burns. Professor Burns served in the United States government for 27 years as a career foreign service officer. He was Under Secretary of State for Political Affairs from 2005 to 2008. Burns is now professor of the practice of diplomacy and international relations at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. He explained his stance when he spoke with Joan Lee of the VOA Korean Service. As you will hear, the conversation took place in a crowded, somewhat noisy room.
I don't think President Trump was tough enough. At Singapore, we suspended our military exercises, and that gave the North Koreans an inducement, a favor that they didn't earn, because the North Koreans have not even declared for us so many months after Singapore. What is the extent of their nuclear apparatus? Where are their nuclear weapons? How many do they have? What type? Where is their fissile material? They haven't even taken the first step in the negotiations, and we've made these fundamental compromises. So I think, from a negotiating point of view, I think the president's been too lenient. And I also think it's very important that we have a very tight integration with South Korea, with President Moon. And frankly, we need to keep the Chinese close. And when President Trump returned from Singapore, you remember he tweeted out, the nuclear problem has been resolved. That allowed China and Russia to begin to trade again because the American president had said the problem has been resolved, and it had not been. So I think that the president has not been a skillful and not been a tough-minded negotiator. I hope he will become that, because while I support diplomacy, we need the North Koreans to make some more significant declarations of what they plan to do with their nuclear program and how they're going to restrain it and hopefully at some point eliminate it.
I mean, do you believe Kim Jong-un's intention that he will completely give up all of his nuclear weapons and delivery systems, all of that? I mean, is that a realistic goal?
It's not a realistic goal. No, I think that my sense of the North Koreans is that they are very happy to have a diplomatic dialogue where the pressure on them is lessened. And they establish themselves as a credible power in the world, an acceptable power. I do not believe that Kim Jong-un will give up his nuclear weapons, because I think that he sees them as his insurance policy for regime survival. So I don't think that he will.
I mean, does that mean that we kind of have to change our objective at this point? Maybe, you know, a little softer objective, you know, preventing them from having ICBM, you know, that's a direct threat to the United States. I mean, what is a realistic goal then?
From a negotiation standpoint, I'm a former State Department diplomat, and I now teach this negotiations of international politics at Harvard. I think it would be a mistake for us to suddenly say, oh, we'll accept the North Korea nuclear program. It's an unacceptable program to the people of Japan and to most South Koreans, a threat. And certainly it's unacceptable, it would be unacceptable, should North Korea achieve the capability to fire a nuclear warhead at Washington, D.C., or Kansas City, or Los Angeles. And so I think, frankly, the president should maintain the posture that we believe that North Korea should dismantle all of its nuclear weapons. That should be the goal. And that we need to ask countries around the world, like China and Russia, to help us achieve that. Why would we concede this point to Kim Jong-un? They have an illegal, under international law, under the non-proliferation treaty, and illicit nuclear program, a secret program. The world deserves to know more about this program. So I think we should stick to our principles here.
I mean, President Trump has been criticizing, you know, the strategic patience of North Korea.
Yeah.
But it seems like now he's kind of patient.
I fear that President Trump is too focused on kind of the symbolism, the pageantry of a summit meeting. And that's what he really wants. President Trump wants a summit. He wants to say, I'm resolving the problem, but he's not resolving the problem.
Mm-hmm.
He's not being truthful to the American people about resolving the problem.
Do you believe there may be a progress out of the second summit that's going to be taking
place? My view is, if I were advising President Trump, I'm not, but if I were advising him, I would say, don't go to Vietnam, unless you know ahead of time the following concessions will be made by Kim Jong-un. If you are able to establish that he's ready to make those concessions, declare all of his nuclear weapons, fissile material, then you go. But if he's not ready to do that, don't go. Don't go twice to summit meetings and get nothing from Kim Jong-un.
President Donald Trump included the possibility of peace in Afghanistan during his State of the Union speech Tuesday night.
In Afghanistan, my administration is holding constructive talks with a number of Afghan groups, including the Taliban. As we make progress in these negotiations, we will be able to reduce our troops' presence and focus on counterterrorism, and we will indeed focus on counterterrorism.
But that possibility has drawn doubt among quite a few experts. I asked Benjamin Hopkins, Director of Asian Studies at George Washington University in Washington, about his reservations.
I think there's long been a need to engage in peace negotiations. I think the problem with the current administration approach is that I don't see the fundamental calculus of the Taliban as a potential peace partner changing in terms of what they want. It seems like the only party that's changed their attitude is the United States under the Trump administration, and the real change has just been a desire to get out.
Are you saying that you just don't trust the Taliban?
I don't think the Taliban's interests have changed, I guess is how I would characterize it. I don't think their public statements or their public interest in terms of what they are seeking, which is essentially a withdrawal of American troops, has changed. I think if there's been a shift in the party's positions, it's been the American willingness under the Trump administration to withdraw from Afghanistan.
How much do you think Donald Trump, the president of the United States, wants those troops out as opposed to what might happen if they do go?
I have not seen any public statements from the administration indicating that there has been a serious discussion of what happens afterwards in terms of if the United States were to withdraw its forces from Afghanistan, what that would mean, number one, for the Afghan government, but number two, for American interest in the region. Now, those conversations could be taking place privately behind the scenes, but there's not been a whole lot of movement in terms of administration policy in this region that would give me a lot of confidence in those conversations happening.
If U.S. troops did withdraw, even a partial withdrawal, how do you paint, what kind of picture do you paint for Afghanistan?
Well, the security of the Afghan government, the security and viability of the Afghan government, as presently constituted, is dependent on the continuation of an American troop deployment in the country. I think almost every observer and commentator would recognize that. And I think most importantly, the Taliban recognizes that. If the United States were to withdraw completely, I think that would put significant question marks over the viability of the Afghan government.
What about the refusal of the Taliban so far in any of these so-called peace talks to talk with the current Afghanistan government?
I think this is a big problem, and it also shows where they believe, quite correctly, the power militarily in the current situation to lie, namely with the United States. And I think the Taliban has always believed and continues to believe that only with the United States out of the way can they militarily defeat the Afghan government. As long as American troops are in the country, they cannot win an armed conflict. But getting the United States out of the way, out of the country, would open up that possibility, especially with regard to a pretty weak Afghan government.
That's just a continuation, then, of what's happened in Afghanistan for centuries, right?
No, I wouldn't say for centuries. It's definitely a continuation of what's happened over the past 18 years. I mean, part of the problem that the Trump administration has both inherited but doubled down on is a lack of clear objective for the United States. There has not been one enunciated since shortly after the fall of the Taliban in 2001. Neither the Bush administration nor the Obama administration, nor now the Trump administration, has clearly articulated a war aim and purpose in Afghanistan. And it's very hard to declare objectives met and thus a victory won when you don't have a clear publicly acknowledged aim that you're fighting for.
Benjamin Hopkins, Director of Asian Studies at George Washington University here in Washington. Coming up, the trade war could result in the U.S. and China hurting the most.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts. And keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
There is a new UN report that warns the U.S.-China trade wars will negatively impact international trade, with the two economic superpowers emerging among the biggest losers. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva at the launch of the report by the UN Conference on Trade and Development.
U.S.-China trade discussions are underway. If no agreement is reached by March 1st, tariffs on $200 billion in Chinese goods will increase from 10% to 25%. A new UNCTAD study warns the repercussions on international trade will be massive, leading to a downturn in the global economy and instability in commodities and financial markets. Pamela Koch Hamilton is director of UNCTAD's Division on International Trade in Goods and Services and Commodities. She says small and lower income countries will suffer, as their exposure to external shocks will make it very difficult for them to maintain any level of resilience.
Stagflation leading to job losses and higher unemployment, and more importantly, the possibility of a contagion effect, or what we call a reactionary effect, leading to a cascade of other trade distortionary measures, because everybody then will get in the game, and it will be very difficult.
The study predicts higher tariffs will trigger currency wars and devaluation. It warns the impact on global value chains and intermediate suppliers will be devastating. For example, the UN report says the relocation from East Asian value chains will result in a reduction of almost $160 billion to the region. Koch Hamilton says the retaliatory tariffs imposed by the United States have not achieved their intended effect. She says they have not resulted in increased domestic production, but rather will lead to a diversion of trade to third countries.
If the tariffs rise to 25%, what will occur is simple. They will limit trade from China. However, it will not be effective in protecting domestic firms. So suppliers in the rest of the world will be more competitive. Trade diversion effects in favor of third countries.
UN economists say the European Union will emerge as the biggest winner, capturing about $70 billion of U.S.-China bilateral trade. They say Japan, Mexico, and Canada will each capture more than $20 billion. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
We are happy you're with us on VOA Asia Weekend. The greatest concentration of Muslims in China is in Xinjiang province, where some 10 million Uyghurs live. Repressed by the Chinese government, more than a million Uyghurs are estimated to be held in detention camps, according to a United Nations report. Beijing calls these detention centers re-education camps and denies any human rights violations are being committed. However, accounts of violations persist, including one from a Uyghur woman who underwent a harrowing journey from a detention camp to the United States. VOA's Saba Shakan has her story.
This woman lives with her children in Fairfax, Virginia, a suburb of Washington, D.C., thousands of kilometers away from where she once faced one of two fates, death or life imprisonment.
I never thought I could come to the U.S. I thought if I could get to Egypt, I would at least be safe there.
Born into a Uyghur Muslim family in Xinjiang province, Meher Gul Tursun had dreams. She modeled for TV ads and then joined a Chinese export firm which allowed her to travel to many Muslim countries. She eventually left that job to join a university in Egypt, got married, and had triplets. Her problems started when she returned home in 2015 to visit her mother.
I was at the Urumqi airport. They separated me from my three children. They placed tape over my mouth and a bag over my head. They handcuffed me, and then they transported me over to the detention camp.
The United Nations reports Muslims are forced to renounce their faith in these re-education camps. Chinese authorities deny this. Marigold claims that she was tortured by Chinese authorities because they believed she was a spy, and also because she refused to renounce her Islamic faith.
During this torture, when it got really intense, I couldn't stop myself. I said, Ya Allah. Then they knew.
It wasn't just physical torture, but mental too.
They talked to me, yesterday your mother died, and your father died, and your brother, sister, and in the prison now, forever cannot go outside, and your son, his head broken, die, and your daughter in the hospital maybe dying near. So you will die also.
She realized if she died, what would happen to her children. So she told Chinese authorities children were Egyptian nationals, and if they were harmed, it would cause a major diplomatic incident. Once Chinese authorities established her children's nationalities, they wanted them out of the country. But the Egyptian embassy demanded to meet the mother. When Marigold did finally meet Egyptian officials, she told them she was also an Egyptian national. And that led to her release from detention and her eventual journey to the United States.
When I was in detention, there were a lot of women who had desires and dreams, and they talk about what they would do if they ever left. And I told myself that now that I am out and before I die, I would be their voice. I'll make sure that they are heard.
And she is doing just that. Recently, Marigold met with U.S. lawmakers to share her story and ask for their support to help the Uyghur Muslims. Sabasha Khan, VOA News, Fairfax, Virginia.
The biggest waste facility ever built in a refugee settlement has begun operating in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh, home to nearly 1 million Rohingya refugees. The UN Refugee Agency, which is funding the project, reports the treatment plant can process the human waste of 150,000 people every day. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
More than 750,000 Rohingya refugees have fled to Cox's Bazar since August 2017 to escape persecution and violence by Myanmar's military in northern Rakhine State. Thousands of other Rohingya have fled to Bangladesh during previous periods of repression in Myanmar. This huge population generates an enormous amount of human waste in the congested settlements where limited land is available suitable for latrine pits and wastewater treatment. The UN refugee spokesman Andre Mahecic says managing the waste in this terrain requires an innovative approach. He calls the new waste treatment facility a major step toward resolving this problem.
The ability to treat large volumes of waste on site rather than having to transport it elsewhere is a critical step to safe and sustainable disposal of such waste in emergency situations. This will significantly reduce health risks for refugees and host communities alike and the likelihood of outbreak of diseases.
For example, he notes more than 200,000 cases of acute diarrhea were reported in the Rohingya camps last year. In addition, he says people are suffering from respiratory infections and skin diseases like scabies as a result of the unhygienic conditions. Mahecic tells VOA UNHCR plans to roll out similar treatment facilities at other sites to ultimately deal with all of the waste being produced on a daily basis.
The point of this is also that the end result is safe, that there will be also biogas production as part of that, and it will be whatever remains is made neutral in such a way that in no way can damage human health.
Mahetich says Bangladeshi authorities have provided the site for the waste facility. He says engineers from UNHCR and the British charity Oxfam, with support from Rohingya refugees, built the new site in just over 7 months. He says the initial cost of developing the site, installing the equipment, operating and maintaining the facility is just under $400,000. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The most recent round of trade talks between the United States and China concluded in Washington last week with no firm deal other than a commitment to keep on talking. Nike Ching reports on the status of the talks between the world's leading economies as they try to find some common ground before more American tariffs come online in early March.
The U.S. Mint is releasing lucky money for 2019, the Chinese Year of the Pig, a sign of prosperity and good fortune. As for whether the two countries are also on a path of prosperity, U.S. President Donald Trump sounds optimistic.
We had an incredible meeting yesterday with the Vice Premier of China, a very powerful man, highly respected, very strong, very respected also by the President, President Xi, and we had an amazing meeting on trade, mostly on trade, actually also on fentanyl. China's agreed to criminalize fentanyl. That's going to have a huge impact on fentanyl coming into the country.
American farmers also feeling upbeat, says Adam Nelson, director of national legislation for the Illinois Farm Bureau.
We have lost sales. And, you know, I think the longer it goes, the more likely it is for these countries to come up with new supply chains. You know, that's the fear.
Author and political commentator Po Kongchen said the positive reception is the result of a calculated decision by China to focus on appealing directly to President Trump.
Liu He sent Xi Jinping a New Year's gift this time. The focus of this negotiation was not on the trade agreement, but on getting Trump to meet with Xi Jinping again. The most important thing for China is to save face for Xi Jinping and to let him have something to show domestically.
In Washington, lawmakers like Senator Marco Rubio praised China's purchase of more U.S. agricultural products, but said more work needs to be done. One of the biggest concerns is technology theft.
China is a great power, is going to continue to be a great nation. It's not about containing China, but there needs to be equilibrium in our relationship. And it cannot be that they can do anything they want here, but they restrict everything we want to do, and it cannot be that they steal the things we innovate and then use that to put our companies out of business.
Tough words from U.S. lawmakers while the negotiating teams continue to meet. The Washington talks had a muted reaction in Beijing, where officials said the next round of dialogue will continue next month in China. Nike Chin, VOA News, State Department.
China is trying to isolate the United States by going after its allies. That is the opinion of at least one analyst. Thomas Wright of the Brookings Institution in Washington told the Guardian newspaper that China is trying to divide and conquer. It wants to put maximum pressure on individual countries and not have them band together. After the arrest of Huawei executive Meng Wanzhou in Canada at the request of the United States, action against three Canadians who were in China was taken by Chinese officials. Two of the Canadians were and still are being detained. The third had a drug sentence changed to death. I spoke about this situation with Asia security expert and consultant Rory Daniels. She said what China is now doing is nothing new.
What China is doing is figuring out how to use its national power to meet its national goals. And it has exercised this power coercively against U.S. allies in Asia before. It did so in 2012 against Japan when it banned rare earth metals after the government in Tokyo purchased a set of islands in the East China Sea that Beijing claims as their own territory. And it did so more recently in 2017 and 2018 against a South Korean department store and conglomerate, the Lotte Group, when the Lotte Group in South Korea gave some real estate to a U.S. radar system, which Beijing claimed could peek into its own territory and believed was targeted against China's security interests. So when it comes to China using national power, what we see is that it prefers bilateral relationships and it prefers to use its economic leverage to coerce or persuade other countries to meet security goals that are beneficial for Beijing.
Is this type of pressure unique to China, or do other countries use it as well?
I would say that probably every country tries to use its leverage to meet its national goals, but what may be different about China is the amount of power it has gained so quickly, and therefore its ability to use that leverage, and also the idea that China may perhaps be pursuing these goals outside of a rules-based framework in which there is an equitable resolution instead of a power-based resolution.
Do you see this being successful on their part, on Beijing's part?
It's successful, but it's not without consequence. So whether or not the short-term successes, for example, coming later to a deal with Japan to shelve the territorial disputes or creating economic incentives for countries to join the Belt and Road Initiative are successful in the long term remains to be seen. In the short term, we're seeing some successes, but also a lot of backlash against some of the practices, particularly investment projects that are not sustainable long term because of the debt they create in the target country.
You're basically talking about Belt and Road, right?
Correct.
All right. Now, give me an example as to how that would be incorporated.
Yeah, I mean, I think you could take the example of the Philippines. So the Philippines has territorial disputes with China in the South China Sea. It brought that case to an international arbitration court. The international arbitration court ruled in favor of the Philippines at the same time that the Philippines had elected a new president, Duterte, who wanted to pursue closer relations with Beijing. So Duterte went to Beijing shortly after this ruling was announced and signed an astronomical series of investment deals in Beijing, and at the press conference to announce those deals made mention that they would not be seeking enforcement for the arbitration ruling.
What are some of these allies doing to fight back against Beijing, if indeed they are doing that?
I think the allies are in a very, very difficult position to fight back against Beijing. On the one hand, you are seeing more scrutiny of Belt and Road investment projects. Even Pakistan, who has traditionally been a stalwart partner of Beijing, is rethinking some of the commitments that it's made to accept Belt and Road financing. But in reality, China is a huge economic power. It has a lot of growth potential still, and most countries want to be involved in China's economic success story. So every country at this point is working very individually to figure out how to balance their need to participate in China's economy with some of these strategies of coercive leverage that come as part of the bargain. What would be an effective strategy would be for all of the allies to band together on this front and really present China with a framework in which funding can be transparent and rules-based but we're not seeing a great deal of global coordination on those efforts.
Australian mining giants Rio Tinto and BHP are supporting greater Indigenous recognition in Parliament. BHP Chief Executive Andrew McKenzie said the company, like the nation as a whole, has unfinished business with the Indigenous peoples of Australia and that it cannot stand on the sidelines. Critics, however, believe it could be a cynical move by the mining sector to gain favor with tribal groups, which have lands rich in natural resources. We have more from Phil Mercer in Sydney.
BHP and Rio Tinto are supporting a campaign to change Australia's constitution to give a formal voice to Aboriginal people in federal parliament. The mining giants employ thousands of Indigenous workers and are backing a demand from community leaders called the Uluru Statement from the Heart, made in 2017, for a special Aboriginal body to advise Parliament. BHP Chief Executive Officer Andrew McKenzie said the reform would empower Indigenous people and would boost the reconciliation process.
We now have a chance to create a new chapter in our history, to create a voice that will establish a bridge across that gulf. Now, I know there are fears that a constitutionally enshrined voice, confirmed by referendum, will deepen cultural divisions and is undemocratic. I don't think those fears stand up to scrutiny.
BHP will contribute about $700,000 to a project raising awareness about the benefits of an Indigenous voice to the Australian Parliament. Many of the company's operations are located on or close to Indigenous land. BHP says it acknowledges the right of First Australians to maintain their culture, identity, traditions and customs. But there is scepticism about the company's motives. Jacinta Price, an Aboriginal councillor in the central Australian city of Alice Springs, believes the miners' support for constitutional reform is a superficial move.
We need to have a bit more of a discussion. I don't know that just simply throwing your support behind something that we're not sure what that actually looks like is helpful. And in a way, perhaps it is a way of these companies to look better in the eyes of Indigenous people, considering it's Indigenous people's land that, you know, they want to be involved in.
Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison has rejected the mining giant's push for greater Indigenous rights in federal parliament. He said he was focused on practical measures to help Aboriginal communities. Indigenous people make up about 3% of the population, but suffer high rates of poverty, ill health and imprisonment. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
One of the important aspects of gauging the damage being done to the world's ecosystems by climate change is knowing the current status of those systems. So a Britain-based charity is about to embark on an expedition to gauge the health of one of the world's few remaining pristine reefs. We dive in with VOA's Kevin Enox.
According to the nonprofit Coral Guardian, coral reefs host about 25% of all the ocean's biodiversity. They also serve as a natural barrier to protect shorelines from punishing storms and waves. But we're losing them.
We've seen mass coral bleaching taking place with an increasing frequency and increasing severity. We're seeing all sorts of other impacts on marine life. And that's now. If we allow the temperature to rise to 2 degrees, then we can pretty much wave goodbye to coral reef ecosystems. And indeed, we will probably lose many other types of marine habitat and many species as well.
Experts say the problem is warming waters, due in part to human activities that contribute to overall climate change.
We've seen a global movement of marine life in order to try and track the temperatures that organisms like to live in. They're moving to the north or to the south, away from the equator.
To better understand what's happening to our reefs, the British nonprofit Necton is about to head to the Seychelles off the coast of Africa to assess these mostly healthy reefs. The team will make a series of dives on board the submersible to better understand what's going on in these reefs.
It's really vital that we go literally out there and see, for example, how our coral reefs are affected by all these CO2 emissions, and which causes acidification and essentially causes the destruction of coral reefs.
The mission will allow the team to understand not only shallow reefs, but also the deeper reefs that are still something of a mystery.
So it would be really interesting to go out there and actually see, in Seychelles in particular, which is one of the places which is relatively pristine still, to see if the effects of climate change are actually evident on the shallow coral reefs, and especially on the deeper reefs that so far no one looked before.
Alex Rogers, an Oxford professor working with Necton, says the information is vital because saving the coral reefs and combating climate change is something the world has to tackle.
We have to make a decision whether we go down a pathway of behaving responsibly or we can continue on the pathway which we're currently on, in which case we're going to see probably a geological scale extinction in the ocean. And it's as simple as that.
The 7-week expedition begins in March. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Now on VOA Asia Weekend, more than 700 people have been sickened with Ebola in the Democratic Republic of Congo, as more than 400 have died. The neighboring countries of South Sudan and Rwanda are bracing for the virus to spread. But half a world away, U.S. researchers are racing to develop a new long-lasting vaccine against the virus. VOA's Carol Pearson joins us with some hopeful news.
In Congo, Ebola claims the lives of 60% of those who get the virus. The disease is so devastating, even those who survive it are shunned.
What really makes it frightening is the high mortality rate, the very severe symptoms that people experience, and, you know, the fact that it comes up when not expected.
The death rate is high even after a vaccine was used in West Africa during an Ebola outbreak that claimed 11,000 lives. Dr. Paul Spearman is leading a U.S. team of investigators to develop better and longer-lasting vaccines. Researchers are conducting a clinical trial that's testing two experimental Ebola vaccines.
We're giving one vaccine and followed 1 week later by another vaccine. And that could give you very rapid protection.
If the vaccine combination proves effective, it could be used in African countries where Ebola breaks out regularly.
These epidemics that occur in several parts of Africa can arise without warning.
The vaccines don't contain the Ebola virus, but they produce a major Ebola virus protein that's designed to get the immune system to react. Study participants are well aware of the health and humanitarian crisis Ebola causes.
Anything that we can do with research, through research, to stop it or prevent it or make it so that it's not something that grows rapidly or spreads rapidly, then I think being a part of something like that is worth it.
To see if these vaccines work, researchers test the volunteers' blood samples, which are collected before getting injected with the experimental vaccine, and also afterwards.
We have baseline after 1 week, after 2 weeks, and we compare the three and then see what difference vaccination makes.
The researchers hope their work could provide clues for other Ebola vaccines, as well as a better understanding of how to build immunity to other pathogens, which are viruses, bacteria, or other bugs that can cause disease. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
The first Starbucks coffee shop opened in Seattle, Washington in 1971 and grew into what is perhaps the world's best-known American coffee company. But in Seattle, it is not the only brew in town. And as Natasha Moskovaya discovered, locals never lost their love and appreciation for an individual approach and experimentation, and small coffee bars mushroomed in the city. Anna Rice shares her report.
Making a cup of coffee at a so-called slow bar takes between 5 and 15 minutes. One of the oldest methods of brewing coffee uses a vacuum pot. A vacuum coffee maker operates as a siphon, where heating and cooling the lower vessel changes the vapor pressure of water, first pushing the water up into the upper vessel, then allowing the water to fall back down into the lower vessel.
And then in the end, it ends up being a really clean cup of coffee. We use two filters. So it makes a cup with a lot of clarity. There's no oils or sediment. So it should have a really sweet finish and also a nice acidity to it, similar to like what you'd find in fruit.
A slow coffee might cost you $12, but here it's not a luxury. It's a way of life.
I'm not really sure. It might just be because like 9 months out of the year, it's raining and dark so that you need something to pick you up. Otherwise, you're just tired all the time. I drink a lot of coffee, yeah. Maybe like 4 cups a day, 5 cups a day.
A thoughtful approach to coffee brings interesting new players to the industry. For instance, the owners of this place, a historian and an anthropologist, decided to open the coffee shop after finishing their PhD degrees. Pipo Bui thinks the days of bad coffee stereotype in the United States are numbered, and soon the habit of grabbing a paper cup and drinking coffee on the go without giving a second thought to its origin will be forgotten.
I think that more and more of the United States citizens, when they can afford it, are looking to invest their money in places that align with their values.
To help cultivate the new coffee culture, Boy and her husband decided to, among other things, send all their baristas to small farms in South America to see for themselves how coffee is grown and collected and learn to experiment with the beans. Many coffee shop owners in Seattle agree with Bui. For them, the coffee revolution that is brewing in the area is well worth the results. For Natasha Moskovaya and Alexander Bergen in Seattle, Washington, Anna Rice, VOA News.
Preparations are underway for the second summit meeting between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. I put together a report on the man who represents the United States in talks with North Korea, beginning his task of coming up with an agenda for the summit, at least in part acceptable to both sides. Senior U.S. and South Korean officials have met to discuss an expected second summit between President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Trump said last Thursday that he'll announce this week the site and date where he'll meet with Kim, expected around the end of February. Trump's special envoy for North Korea, Stephen Bagan, arrived in South Korea Sunday amid reports that he would meet with North Korean officials early this week to work out details for the summit. Monday, Seoul's presidential office said that Bagan met with South Korea's national security advisor to discuss the planned Trump-Kim meeting. Last Thursday, Bagan told a gathering at Stanford University in California that Washington is willing to discuss many actions to improve ties and entice Pyongyang to give up nuclear weapons, but set out an extensive list of demands for the North, including a full disclosure of its weapons program.
Before the process of denuclearization can be final, we must also have a complete understanding of the full extent of the North Korean weapons of mass destruction and missile programs. We will get that at some point through a comprehensive declaration. We must reach agreement on expert access and monitoring mechanisms of key sites to international standards. And ultimately, we need to ensure the removal and destruction of stockpiles of fissile material, weapons, missiles, launchers, and other weapons of mass destruction. All of this must be addressed in a roadmap of working-level negotiations that will be essential if we are to put in place the necessary conditions to fundamentally transform U.S.-North Korean relations and establish a peace, permanent peace, on the Korean Peninsula.
Bagan did not elaborate on what concessions the United States might make, but said the corresponding measures demanded by North Korea would be the subject of talks next week. The U.S. negotiator said the United States is fully aware that Pyongyang has not fulfilled its promise to do away with its nuclear capabilities.
North Korea has a significant and potentially dangerous capacity in weapons of mass destruction. We all know that. North Korea has given us little indication that they have yet made the decision to completely dismantle and destroy that capability. We all know that. Therefore, what is the question? And what President Trump has done is directed the Secretary of State to engage diplomatically through a combination of pressure and incentives to see if we can invite North Korea to make a different set of choices. That's the complete picture. It's not that we're deceived. It's not that we don't know what's going on. It's not that we don't take the threat with the gravity that it requires. And by the way, we have enormous capacities to deter that threat as well. So if I were presenting the same information, I would say that we have the potential here for a grave threat to the United States of America And therefore, it is all the more urgent that we engage diplomatically with North Korea to see if we can change the trajectory of their policies by changing the trajectory of our own. And that's what we're trying to do.
Bacon said, from our side, we are prepared to discuss many actions that could help build trust between our two countries and advance further progress in parallel on the Singapore summit objectives of transforming relations, establishing a permanent peace regime on the peninsula, and complete denuclearization.
President Trump is ready to end this war. It is over. It is done. We are not going to invade North Korea. We are not seeking to topple the North Korean regime. We need to advance our diplomacy alongside our plans for denuclearization in a manner that sends that message clearly to North Korea as well. We are ready for a different future. It's bigger than denuclearization while it stands on the foundation of denuclearization. But that's the opportunity we have, and those are the discussions we will be having with North Koreans.
Bacon said the past 25 years of talk showed the possibility of failure was great, and he stressed we need to have contingencies if the diplomatic process fails, which we do. Ira Melman, VOA Asia, Washington. A prominent Kenyan newspaper reports that top officials there may have imperiled key strategic assets when it signed a 2014 contract deal with China for the country's standard gauge railway. Salam Solomon has the story.
As it winds through Kenya's lush national parks, the Standard Gauge Railway, the country's largest infrastructure project since independence, seems like a symbol of progress. Some experts argue the railway will support Kenya's long-term development.
The Standard Gauge Railway is a real game changer. And now you have a railway where you can get on a train and you can arrive at the other end in 5 hours.
The railway connects Nairobi and Mombasa, Kenya's two largest cities. Before the SGR, it took 10 to 15 hours to drive between the cities on a stretch of poor roads.
That is completely game-changing for people movement, but I think perhaps more importantly for goods movement.
But a new report by the Daily Nation, Kenya's largest independent newspaper, suggests a hidden cost. It claims the multi-billion dollar loan with China to build the railway could imperil Kenya's sovereignty and assets. Details of the 2014 contract between Kenya and the Export-Import Bank of China emerged in early January. Beijing's infrastructure deals and the structure of its loans are typically kept secret. The Nation report says it obtained a copy of the pact and raised concerns on the scope of assets Kenya must forfeit if it defaults on the loan. The contract also stipulates that Kenya must use Chinese goods, technology and services in the railway's construction and operation. A confidentiality clause prohibits the Kenyan government from disclosing the terms of the contract without Beijing's expressed written consent. The excerpts provide some of the most tangible evidence to date that Beijing may engage in what critics characterize as debt-trap diplomacy, lending designed to force countries into handing over land, minerals, and strategic assets when they default on a loan. The Nation didn't reveal how it acquired the contract nor how it determined its authenticity. But language in the document closely matches contracts VOA reviewed for projects tied to the Belt and Road Initiative, China's trillion-dollar global infrastructure plan in Serbia, Kyrgyzstan, and Guyana. These contracts suggest the terms of the Kenya loan may reflect Beijing's lending practices across Africa and beyond. Since launching in 2017, the SGR has been marred by allegations of corruption, racism, and poor management. Both Kenyan and Chinese officials have faced criminal charges. President Uhuru Kenyatta pushed back against claims that Chinese lending has hurt the country.
My friends, we are ahead of our payment schedule. We are not tied to any country, but we are working together with those who appreciate and understand Kenya's developmental needs, China being one of them. China is a very, very strong supporter of Kenya's development agenda.
He added that Kenya will continue to borrow for development. I'm Salim Solomon for VOA News, Washington.
We wish you a happy new year as we begin the year of the pig together on VOA Asia Weekend. One way to take in the new year is to see a stage performance. Kleptocracy is a play based on the collapse of the Soviet Union and is the work of award-winning Asian-American playwright Kenneth Lin. You may already be familiar with Lin's work on the second and third season of the hit Netflix series House of Cards. VOA Asia's Anna Cook sat down with Lin to talk about the details of his journey as an Asian writer in the United States.
You're good. So, I guess congratulations are in order. Congratulations.
That was a scene from Kleptocracy, the most recent work written by Kenneth Lin.
I wasn't always sure that I wanted to be a writer.
Kenneth Lin, now an award-winning playwright of numerous plays and screenwriter of House of Cards, says his journey as an aspiring Chinese-American writer was not always obvious and smooth.
It was hard at first because I even remember, like, I had managers and things like that that were like, oh, you're a really great writer and we want you to do X, Y, and Z, but, you know, you must understand that we can't have stories that have Asian characters in them.
Since House of Cards, Lin's most recent project is a play called Kleptocracy, a fictional play inspired by historic events during the collapse of the Soviet Union, now showing in Washington's theater arena stage.
I would go out to Los Angeles by myself, and I would end up sleeping in rooms that had no furniture or sleeping in my car sometimes and, like, bathing with a baby wipe before meetings because, you know, I was so broke. But I knew that if I didn't put myself out there, if I didn't go and fall often, that I was never going to be able to do it. So it was a lot of just trial and error.
Lin's background coming from a hardworking immigrant family to this day is a core influence on his job as a playwright.
I spent most of my childhood in Long Island, where my family had a restaurant. And I grew up in this restaurant. So a restaurant is really very much show business. As a child, my grandmother always told me that, like, the best always has to go to the people who are coming here tonight. And I think about that in terms of my writing.
They say that Mikhail Borisovich Khodorkovsky is three generations of Rockefellers rolled into one man.
You know, I think we do come to the theater to be nourished. You know, I think of that as my job, is to nourish the people that are coming.
Upcoming works to look forward to from Lin include a musical adaptation of Farewell, My Concubine, and a TV show based on the writings of Bruce Lee called Warrior, all of which focus on Asian characters.
But at the time, you know, the world was different, and people really weren't looking for stories written by Asian people. Now I think things are different, and things are beginning to open up. I no longer feel as though I can't write about my Asian American experience, and it won't have an audience. You know, I feel pretty confident that it will now.
Playwright Kenneth Lin in a conversation with VOA Asia's Anna Cook. Finding a comfortable working environment can sometimes be difficult, especially for women working in male-dominated fields like science and technology. But some new startups are all about creating spaces that cater to and are dominated by women. VOA's Kevin Enox has more.
This is the Riveter Workspace, a unique shared space that allows women and women-owned businesses to gather and work together.
We saw a real need to provide not only physical space, but also the greater community that comes with that to help support women first.
The idea of this Seattle-based startup is simple. This is open office space. Companies or individuals can rent space, anything from a desk to a large office, and work alongside other women.
So I recently started a business called Money Muse. It's basically financial literacy coaching and events for women.
Stephanie Zenos has a space here. She is no stranger to male-dominated workspaces.
Especially being in the space industry, it's male-dominated, and so my whole life I've been the only woman in the room. And I guess I wanted to change that. I wanted to see what it was like to be around a community of strong, you know, badass women, and see what that was like.
The businesses are as diverse as the clientele.
We use graphic design to help global health organizations.
It is a curated rental clothing service.
People like Jamie Russo, who study workplace evolution, see this as a natural evolution.
As you start to learn more and the market starts to evolve, there start to be more options that are a little more specific or niche-y to fit what specifically someone might be looking for. So the women-focused spaces are a great example.
Stephanie Zenos sees it as an outgrowth of the kind of female empowerment that led to the Me Too movement.
And I know, you know, with sexual harassment, it's a big problem in a lot of industries and in a lot of places, and oftentimes you don't get support from women, even as a victim of sexual harassment. So I think now that Kat's kind of out of the bag, women are being more supportive of others outwardly.
And while the Riveter was created for women, company leaders point out that men are welcome too, and that about a quarter of Riveter's members are men. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Thank you for being with us for VOA Asia Weekend. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Make certain you join us next weekend. And remember, you can stay up to date 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on our website at voanews.com.